Last week, I gave a sermon on the phrase Our Father, and I showed how that actually applies throughout the entire prayer. It influences the entire prayer, the sample prayer that was given by Christ. And those two words, if you apply those two words then to every single other section throughout the entire prayer, you get a great deal more meaning out of the sample prayer and are able to pray that sample prayer more effectively. And I'm hoping that certainly through this week that has elapsed since then, that you have been thinking of that as you've actually prayed, that you've actually been able to just think, well, Our Father, and just what that actually means, and apply it in the various other sections of your prayer as you pray that prayer, and go through each section elaborating on it in your own personal lives. But today what I want to do is I want to highlight something else that I think also needs to influence all of our prayers, particularly today, because we live in a world which is very different from any other time in history. I mean, when you think about it, me talking into a microphone, and the microphone is actually then taking my words across the entire earth, it is a world completely different from anything else that we've ever had in history. Turn with me over to Luke chapter 18, because this passage in Luke 18, it follows on from the end of Luke 17, where it's talking about remembering Lot's wife in verse 32. It talks about the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, verse 29, it rained fire and brimstone. Even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed, when the covers come off and you actually have the fact that you we see the 1,335 days start and the actual countdown goes forward. Then the church actually has to flee in the same way as Noah entered into the ark, in the same way as Lot fled from Sodom. That actually occurred at that time. And it talks about how one will be taken, another left, and the disciples asked where in verse 37, and he said wherever the body is there, the eagles will be gathered together, giving a hint as to where in fact that place is going to be. And then he goes into chapter 18, in that context, in the context of the end time, and it says, and he spoke a parable to them to this end, that men ought to always to pray and not to faint. Now, last week I gave a sermon on Our Father and applying those two words to our sample, to the sample prayer, and the prayers that we make on a daily basis. And here Christ is also saying, in the context of the time that we find ourselves in today, well, here's a parable to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to faint, not to give up. But we should be praying. We should be a praying church. Saying, there was in a city a judge which feared not God, and neither regarded man. And there was a widow in that city, and she came unto him, saying, avenge me of my adversary. Notice what she was saying. Avenge me of the adversary. And the adversary to us is Satan. That's what the word Satan actually means. Satan means the enemy, the adversary. And he wouldn't for a while, but afterward he said within himself, though I don't fear God or regard man, yet because the widow troubles me, I'll avenge her, thus by a continual coming would weary me. And the Lord says, you just notice what the unjust judge said. Shall not God avenge his own elect, which cried day and night to him, though he bear long with them? Now, Mr. Armstrong, in the actual broadcast we just listened to, and in several of the broadcasts, he's talking about this generation will not pass. And the understanding at that particular time when he was giving that that broadcast was a generation was something like 20 years, 25 years. Therefore, the generation wouldn't pass. Therefore, 25 years, 30 years, perhaps, at the outside. We understand today, looking at the actual events, is that no, this generation that heard the message, that generation isn't going to die away. It isn't going to die off. So we still find ourselves within that generation, but our view is slightly different. But here it says, hear what the unjust judge says. Shall not God avenge his own elect, which cry day and night to him, that don't give up, that keep on getting on our knees and asking him to intervene? And we see the news, we see the things that are going on in the world, we see the way in which society is drifting steadily downwards. The morals are on a toboggan slide. Mr. Armstrong used to say that, as far as the morals were concerned, they're even worse today. And he says, which cry unto him day and night, though he bear long with them. Though, in fact, we have to go on and keep on keeping on. And he says that he spoke this parable that men ought always to pray and not give up, to keep praying, to keep praying to God, asking for the avenging on of our adversary, of Satan, removal of Satan, and the kingdom of God to actually begin. I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. When it actually happens, everything is going to happen very suddenly, very quickly. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, shall he find faith on the earth? Is the faith still going to be there? Are we still going to be having the faith? Now, in the time when you think about it, at this particular time, when these things which are being mentioned are in the end of Luke 17 are actually occurring, we are going to need faith. The lead-up to that time, when we are actually praying, avenge us of our adversary, and we see the events occurring, things that we've thought were going to happen in such a way that we, as a church, as one body of the church, we'd all be taken to a place of safety, and it would almost then the Laodicea would arise. It hasn't worked out like that. We find ourselves in a society which is Laodicean in character. We don't know who is Laodicean and who is not yet. We've got to wait until that separation occurs. But it's not the way we actually imagined it. We saw the shattering of the church. We saw the problems coming from actually within the church, which again was not something that we happened. We'd see that it was about to happen. But he says, nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, shall he find faith on the earth? We need to keep the faith of Christ. We need to have the faith of God, trusting God. Yes, but having that kind of faith, the faith that comes through the very Spirit of God, which has been mentioned in the broadcast today. But you know, we live in a very different time, a very different time from when these words were actually uttered. Let me ask you a question. When did you last pray for rain? When did you last pray for rain so that you could actually have your food grow? I know, yes, in farming circles, yes, we should be praying for rain. I would imagine that many of the people I'm talking to here have prayed for rain. But I can hazard a guess that some of you that are listening to my words over the internet have never prayed for rain so that your food may grow. But do you think they had to pray for rain before, in days gone by when they had famines and so on within Judea? You bet they did. Of course they did. Do you think they have to trust God for their daily bread? I mean, where's our faith today? What's the faith for your food? Well, faith that there'll be some food in the supermarket. It's not the same way as it was at that time. The faith is that the rain would come, that we would be able to plant the seeds, that we'd have the seeds not eaten, the young plants not eaten, and then we'll have something to harvest. That we'll have actually the young stock would grow properly, that they wouldn't cast their young, and so on. That's the way in which it has always been within the agricultural community. But today we don't live in the agricultural community. We live in our flats, in our condominiums, or whatever they call them. And we therefore, you say, well, when the Son of Man comes, shall he find faith on the earth? Is he going to have, because we don't have to get on our knees and ask for food every day. We go on a supermarket, we have our trust in the supermarket. Eventually, that trust is going to be shattered. We're going to find that it's ill-founded. But it's interesting that look at the context of this section. He's talking about faith, the faith that we need at this end time, the faith that we need to keep on praying on a daily basis to this end, that we always pray and not to faint, not to give up. And in that context, he spoke a parable, verse 9, to certain that trusted themselves they were righteous and despised others. So there's a problem there. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a publican. And the Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you, I'm not as other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican. I fast twice in a week, I give tithes of all I possess. And the publican, standing afar off, wouldn't even lift as much his eyes to heaven and smote his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And the difference here, I tell you this, man went down to his house justified rather than the other, for everyone that exalts himself shall be abased. He that humbles himself shall be exalted. In other words, the very primary thing that we need when we are praying, the primary thing we need is to make sure that we get the relationship right. This is where fasting comes in. Fasting helps us to get that relationship right. It helps us to feel down to our innermost being just what we are, which is a bag of bones. and that helps the relationship. And if we have the relationship right, then we can get through with our prayers. And if we have the relationship right, we have the faith that we need in God. The faith of Christ, and then we can get the faith of Christ. Then that can be given to us, that we need from the very Spirit of God. But we have the kind of trust that is necessary. It's interesting, he then goes on a little bit further on. He says, verse 15, and they brought unto him infants that he would touch them. And when his disciples saw it, they rebuked them. But Jesus called and said, you allow these little children to come to me? Forbid them not, for of such are the kingdom of heaven. Truly I say to you, whoever shall not receive the kingdom of God as a little child is not even going to be in there. Is not even going to be in that kingdom of heaven. So this humility, this need to be able to get this relationship right, to be able to look upon God in the right way, it's all tied in with the prayer that he's talking about, praying and not giving up. It's also tied in with the kind of faith that's on the earth. And the prayer, the humility, the faith is all tied in with an end time setting that we find here. Now we're going to find, the reason for giving this sermon today is that we are about to enter a time when faith is absolutely vital. Absolutely vital. And yet we live in a world which is so radically different from the way things were years ago. We live in a world where knowledge has increased dramatically. We live in a world where knowledge is amazing. Amazing technology exists that we take for granted. We don't even think when we turn on a light. The light turns, you press the button, the light comes on. We just take the whole thing for granted. And yet we're divorced from reality. At the same time as this is happening, at the same time we have all these technological marvels, we're divorced from the reality. We look at food that comes from a supermarket. We're divorced from the fact that we take seed and we go into the garden and we stick the seed in the ground and we grow our own food. And we save the seed then for the following year. Or we have, if it's a perennial like a carrot or a parsnip or something like that, I think they call them white carrots in the States, then it's a biennial. And we wait until we plant a carrot and then we get the seed for the next year, so it's a biennial. But we're divorced from this. We're divorced from this reliance on God and the things that are of God. And we live in our flats, we live in our homes, we live in our condominiums or whatever else we live in. And the faith that we have is, it says when he comes, you're going to find the faith on the earth. Materialism is the problem with faith. Mr. Armstrong brought this out very clearly. Materialism is a huge problem that we have at this time with faith. The fact that, and why is Satan funneling everybody into cities? Why is Satan funneling everybody away from the land? Even the farmers don't get on their land. They don't get their hands dirty. In some cases, they sit in the tractor, which is costing about 70, 80,000, 90,000 pounds or whatever it is, $150,000, something like that. And they drive around the fields with a great spread of implements behind them. And the air conditioning and so on is going. And the actual link to the land is missing from what it was before. So we're divorced from the reality, we're divorced from the works of God, we live in this godless, materialistic society, and we wonder why faith is a problem. We wonder why we don't recognize that this trust in God, this reliance in God, when we don't even recognize the reliance for our own food that we put in our mouth every day, and four times a day, we go ahead and we feed our faces. And we don't recognize where that's come from if we're not careful, because it comes from a supermarket. So what I want to do today, I want to talk about faith and the works of God. And I want to do so because I want to show you how God actually commands us to consider his works. He commands. It's not a suggestion. It is a command that we actually to consider what he has done, what he has made. And it's particularly so, it's actually commanded, we'll go and look at a section there that is commanded, when our faith is low. When our faith is low, we need to recognize the power of God. Because it's the power of God that is going to sort out our problems for us. And so often, we can find ourselves with problems, with difficulties, and yet we're divorced from the reality that God has made. We live in this own little cocooned world that man has made, and we wonder why we've got problems with faith. Well, this is a problem. This is a problem. And yet today, as I'll go on and show you, there is less excuse because we know more. We actually have more information, and yet we have this problem. So what I want to do is I want to talk first of all about avenging me of my adversary, look at some scriptures in Revelation regarding that, and the one in Psalms. I want to talk about the lesson from Job, because you know, when you look at the Pharisee here, the Pharisee talking, I fast twice in the week, I give tithes of all I possess, I do all this, I do this, I've ticked this box, I've ticked that box. And it even goes on, if you read on after the section we ended on, it goes into this man that says, good master, what good thing must I do to inherit eternal life? And yes, the answer was, keep the commandments. But also the answer was, how the commandments are keeping to be kept, in the sense that he says, why are you calling me good? There's none good but one. That one is God. You can't be good enough on a human level. And this is what Job had to understand. So the lesson of Job, I'd like to go into that a little bit. Secondly. Thirdly, I want to talk about considering the lily. That is not a suggestion. That is a command. Consider the lily, how it grows. And it goes on until it says, O ye of little faith. He ties in faith with this subject of considering the lily. And I want to go and look at that particular aspect. I want to look at the subject of creative grandeur, because there's a grandeur in creation that we can see. The stars, the planets, again, from the Hubble telescope, we have an even greater view today than we ever have had before. We have a knowledge today which is way beyond anything that they had before. And then finally, I want to talk about creative quality. Because again, when you're looking at what God has done, what he has made, and you recognize him as the creator. I mean, you're talking about, you know, consider the lily of the field. We actually have some lilies here as the flowers arrangement. And they are stunningly beautiful. There's no question. They are stunningly beautiful. Now, they're shedding their... the stamens are shedding their pollen a little bit at the moment. And you've got to be careful with if you don't want to get it on. We actually moved it over onto the side because we didn't want it on the tablecloth here. But they are absolutely stunningly beautiful. So let's have a look at this first subject, this first point, that we avenge me of my adversary. Now turn over to Revelation chapter 13. Revelation 13. Right in the heart of the section on Revelation 13, which Revelation 12 and Revelation 13 are inset chapters. Revelation 12 deals with the true church. Revelation 13 deals with the false church and system. And it is put in right in the heart of Revelation because there's about to be a bust-up between the two of them, basically. That's what we're looking at. Christ has returned just beforehand, and you're now moving into the time when Christ is taking action within the earth. And here, right in the heart of Revelation 13, it says, if any man have a... Verse 9, it says, if any man have an ear, let him hear. So who is the ones having an ear? Well, the ones having an ear are those that are actually converted, those that are actually following Jesus Christ at this particular time, those that have the Spirit of God and being led by the Spirit of God, those are the only ones that really have an ear. Let him hear. He that leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He that kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. Now we are going to have patience. We've had to have patience over these last 25 years. But we are going to have patience. We are also going to have faith, trusting God, allowing him to go ahead and work things out for us, and keeping on our knees as we do so, you know, praying and not giving up. But part of the thing that we are going to have as well is the fact that we understand that he who lives into captivity will themselves go into captivity. And those that are killed with a sword are in fact going to be killed with a sword. And we're going to have to rely on that a great deal more. Put a marker in Revelation, because we're going to be going into Revelation 14 in a minute. But Psalm 94. Let's have a look at Psalm 94, first of all. And just read what it has to say here in Psalm 94. It says, O eternal God, to whom vengeance belongs. Remember, the widow was praying, avenge me of my adversary. And won't God avenge his elect that cry to him night and day, that see the problems, that sigh and cry for the abominations that they see in the news? And believe you me, as you go through the news, and I know Mr. Henderson certainly appreciates this probably more than the rest of us, because he trawls through the news to get the dozen or so items that he puts, or 10 items that he puts up there. But Psalm 94, O eternal God, to whom vengeance belongs, O God, to whom vengeance belongs, show yourself. You know, again, it fits like a glove to the time that we find ourselves in. Lift up yourself, you judge of the earth, render a reward to the proud. Eternal, how long shall the wicked triumph? How long shall they utter and speak the hard things, and all the workers of iniquity boast themselves? They break in pieces your people, O Eternal. They afflict your inheritance. They slay the widow, the stranger. They murder the fatherless. And that's happening continually. Abortion is going by leaps and bounds. They're murdering the fatherless. They're giving moral issues that encourage the fatherless, and then they murder them. They slay the widow, the stranger, murder the fatherless, yet they say, the Eternal shall not see, neither shall the God of Jacob regard it. They don't even believe in God, in many cases. Understand, you brutish among the people, and you fools, when are you going to be wise? When are you going to wake up to what reality is? When are you going to understand what is real? He that planted the ear, shall he not hear? He that formed the eye, shall he not see? He that let's just think a little bit. And again, it's only recently that we've been able to understand a little bit about the ear. He that formed the ear. Let me just read something out of a book that we've got on the way in which the young baby actually develops on ears. It says, the ear consists of three different parts and originates in three different regions. In the fourth week, a bubble is turned inward from the skin on both sides of the rear part of the brain. This bubble will later become the inner ear with its auditory and balance organs, all by itself. A bubble forms, goes inwards, and becomes the inner ear, just like that. In the fifth week, the outer ear with the auditory canal on the outer side of the eardrum is developed at the upper end of the first gill groove. The rest will close. You know how you see the fetus with these like grooves at the side. They're not gills at all, nothing to do with gills. They're actually part of the actual formation of the rest of the organs. From the pharynx, a bulge of mucous membrane emerges, giving rise to the middle ear, where the various bones of the malleus with the hammer, anvil and stirrup then develop. So all by itself, these bones suddenly start to form. The middle ear will maintain its connection with the air passage through the eustachian tube. And again, this happens over and over and over again. Totally accepted and totally, you know, how many, even today, the birth of young. I mean, in a farming environment, you have young being born all the time. Chickens hatching, you have lambs being born, kids being born. You see it all the time. And you see this wonder and this amazing wonder that is which is there. And you see it again this time of year. You see it out in the wild as well. Eyes. The creation of an eye is a remarkable example of the interaction, or one could say the dialogue, between the developing brain and the thin skin of the embryo. Yeah, who made it? First, the anterior part of the brain sends out a hollow stem on each side. So the brain itself actually grows a stem coming out on either side. The end of the stem expands to form a vesicle, and when the vesicle approaches the surface of the skin, it turns inward like a cup. So it goes out, it forms a projection, and then it turns inward on itself. At the same time, instructions are forwarded to the skin, quote, make a lens. Just like that. Make a lens. The skin then pinches off a bubble, which is placed in the opening of the cup. So the skin
just pinches itself, knows where it is, pinches itself a bubble, and it makes a lens formed out of skin. Same stuff here, same cells, but the cells suddenly know where it is.
The lens, the skin then pinches off a bubble, which is placed in the opening of the cup, forming a lens. Then, quote, make a cornea. And the skin covering the lens transforms itself into a thin, transparent cornea. On the front of the lens, the iris grows from the edges out inwards. And the iris is a muscling that actually controls the actual the amount of light that's going to come in and out of the aperture. Finally, the surrounding skin is folded and forms two eyelids, and the eye is complete. Just like that. As I say, we know so much today. And here it says, they say the Lord shan't see it, neither shall the God of Jacob regard it. Understand, you brutish among the people, you fools, when will you be wise? It's in the context of vengeance. Avenge me of my adversaries is the parable that Christ gives. And this is what he's saying. He's saying, he that planted the ear and made the ear actually develop, shall he not hear? He that formed the eye, shall he not see? And today we should have no problem with understanding this, because the detail and the understanding that we have of the workings of the body are that much greater. He that chastens the heathen, shall he not correct? He that teaches man's knowledge, is he not going to know? The Eternal knows the thoughts of man, that they are vanity. Blessed is the man who you chasten, O Lord, and you teach him out of your law. So the psalm here is talking about vengeance, and he's talking about vengeance on people that dismiss the creation, dismiss what is actually there, what is can be seen. Now, if we go back to Revelation and look in Revelation 14, where it talks about avenging me of my adversary, here in Revelation 14, here is the culmination that we will, you know, how long away is this going to be? Is this going to be 5 years from now? 4 years from now? 10 years from now? We don't know exactly how long. But it could be 5 years. Could easily be 5 years from right now. Here in Revelation 14, verse 6, he says, I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven. And remember, this is after the seventh angel sounded in verse 15 of chapter 11. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to those that dwell on the earth and every nation and kindred, tongue and people. So what is part of the gospel? What is part of the gospel message? Well, notice what it says. Saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made heaven and earth, the seas, and the fountains of water. Now, it sounds awfully familiar, because if you go back to the Sabbath day, and it says, for in 6 days God made heaven and earth, and so on. And here is the same kind of message coming out. Remember, it's in the context of what else? The mark of the beast also is going on at this time. So here is a message that comes out, talking about the creator God, the creating God. And there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city that made all nations drink the wine of the wrath of a fornication. The confusion of the language, confusion of the truth, the twisting of the truth, that is going to be taken away. And then the third angel followed, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast and his image and receive the mark on his forehead or his hand, the same shall drink the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture and undiluted into the cup of his indignation. And he will be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and the presence of the Lamb. Because at his return, he will destroy. The end of Habakkuk, is it? It talks about this. How the rays will come from his sides and will destroy all those that resist him. It's interesting. I clipped this article out back in April 13th, 2007, about the current Pope. It's entitled, Pope Stirs Up the Evolution Debate. The Pope has made his first comments on evolution, saying God alone cannot provide an explanation for the variety of life on Earth. I would not depend on faith alone to explain the whole picture, Benedict said, according to a new book, Creation and Evolution, published in Germany. Now, he says the theory of evolution is not completely provable because mutations over hundreds of thousands of years cannot be reproduced in a laboratory, he said. He says popular and scientific texts often say that nature or evolution has done this or that, but who is that this nature or evolution as an active subject? It doesn't exist at all, he said. So he's kind of mixing one with another, mixing the beliefs. And again, it says Babylon, whoever has the mark of the beast, whoever goes down that route, and that mark of the beast is the Sunday worship, recognizing that as the day of the resurrection, as opposed to the commandment that comes from God regarding the Sabbath. And what's the commandment from God regarding the Sabbath? It is that he is the creator. And it's a memorial of the creation that's gone. It's a memorial, it's looking forward to the creation that's coming, in the very creation of the children of God. So here we see these three angels, and we see the avenge me of my adversary certainly being very prominent at the end time. We see the fact that if any man hear, let him hear, whoever leads into captivity will go into captivity. This is the faith and the patience of the saints. It's something we've got to hold on to, that we keep going to God in prayer as we see the news, as we see the things that are happening around us, that we do keep on our knees before God. And we do say, avenge us of our adversary, because that is what we are fighting against. That's what we're going to have to fight against as we go from this point forward. And the idea that we can, you know, sit in our little flat and close the doors behind us and think nice thoughts and that's all there is to it. There's more to it than that. This is the God we're talking about. We're not talking about some kind of God you tuck in your back pocket. It's the creator. It is the maker of all these things, of these flowers that I'm looking at the moment. He designed the processes that make them. And this is what Job didn't seem to understand in the way that he needed to. And if you go back to Job, let's have a look at, first of all, Job 23. And just see the kind of religion that Job had, the kind of understanding that God had. Now, Job was a righteous man, no question about that. But he was human righteousness until he became converted, in the sense that he saw what the difference was between himself and God. He then started to really understand. It was no longer self-righteousness. It became the righteousness which was God-based, entirely God-focused. Because here in chapter 23 it says, Job answered and said, even today is my complaint bitter. My stroke is heavier than my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come before his, even to his seat. I would order my cause before him, and I fill my mouth with arguments. I mean, does he really know who he's approaching? Does he really understand that? I would know the words which he would answer me, and understand what he would say to me. He's treating God almost like an equal. This is the difference between the Pharisee that was saying, you know, I fast twice in the week, I do this, I do that, I do the other thing, and the young ruler that came and says, well, all these things I've done from my youth. And the publican that said, didn't even lift his hands, eyes to heaven, saying, have mercy on me, a sinner. Because he recognized the difference between this being that he was actually approaching, and he had the attitude of mind of a young child. And this is the difference that we see. And when we see in chapter 38, we go back to 38, and we read what God then had to say to Job and remind Job. He said in verse 4, he says verse 2, who is this that darkens counsels by words without knowledge? And Job was an incredibly educated, knowledgeable individual. You know, he was an architect par excellence. Gird up now your loins like a man. I'm going to demand of you, and you are going to answer me. There's no messing about with God. This is Jesus Christ. This is Jesus Christ talking to Job. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Declare if you have understanding.
Do we even today understand? I mean, this oil well that's spewing it out in the Gulf of Mexico. How much of it is there down there? How much pressure is there there? How much further deep down do we understand? I mean, the crust, we've gone 6 miles into the Earth. Okay, 6 miles into the Earth sounds an incredible amount. It is nothing. I mean, what's the circumference of the Earth is 23,000 miles. You work out your diameter, pi, all the rest of it, whatever. But how deep do you know? And what do you find down there where we know volcanoes spew out volcanic ash and they pumice and all this kind of thing? We believe that there is some kind of a molten metal core in the center because it gives us our protection from solar winds. But do we really understand it? Do we really know? How? You know, nobody's gone down there. You can't drill down there. So where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Declare if you've got understanding. Who has laid the measure thereof, if you know? Or who stretched the line on it? Where's this foundation fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof? You know, the foundation of reality itself. When we first start, can we understand that? Can we make any kind of a stab at it that is, you know, justifiable? When the morning stars, the very angels, sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy, the created sons of God shouted for joy. Or who shut up the sea with doors and it broke forth as it issued out of the womb? When I made the cloud a garment thereof and thick darkness as a swaddling band for it and broke up it from the decreed places and set bars and doors. And so here is this being that commands the very sea. And he commands, he actually creates by speaking his word. And here's Job saying that, oh, if I could just sit down with this God, that God who I know, is he really the God he knows? Is he really any kind of concept? Verse 17, have the gates of death been opened to you? Do you understand what happens in death? We know the spirit returns to God who gave it. But what exactly is the link? Well, how does it link in with a physical mind? You answer that. I don't have the answer. Job didn't have the answer, but God does. God certainly does. Have you seen the doors to the shadow of death? Do you understand death? Do you understand what actually happens? Verse 19. Where is the way that light dwells? What's a photon? What exactly is it? A wave? Is it a particle? What is it? We don't know. What's an electron? We don't know. And darkness, where's the place of that? You know, is it just absence of light? Is there any... They used to believe there was an ether. They had all kinds of weird and wonderful ideas. And we've also, today, got all kinds of weird and wonderful ideas. But we don't know. We don't have the kind of knowledge that God does. Verse 28, has the rain a father? Can we make rain? Can you go ahead and say, right, I'm going to have, I think we'll leave it, we'll leave this sunny weather for about 3 or 4 days so we can have the barbecue. And then after that, the garden needs a drop of rain, so we'll go ahead and have that. Can you make that happen and guarantee it? Not in Britain, you can't, I can tell you that. Has the rain a father? And who has begotten the drops of dew? Have you done that? Is that something? Verse 31, can you bind the sweet influences of Pleiades, loose the bands of Orion? Orion at this time is not there. I mean, it's basically gone, sunk down below the horizon. But come the winter time, Orion comes up and we can see Orion and the belt. But can we influence them? Can we do anything about it? Can we make Orion kind of whiz across the sky and go somewhere else? No, we can't. Can God and Jesus Christ, if they wanted to, they could. He could even stop the sun, as he's done in Joshua's long day. Hezekiah, oh well, I'm not going to have the sun go forward, make it go backwards 15 degrees. So, verse 36, who has put wisdom in the inward parts? Who has given understanding to the heart? Do we understand the spirit in man? We understand that it gives human understanding. But how? What's the interface with a human being? How does that work? Are we any concept? These things we simply don't know.
the it goes on into chapter 39, verse 19. It says, "Have you given the horse strength? Have you closed his neck with thunder? Did you make it? Did you form this eye? Did you form this ear that I just read about?" This is Job, who is having a certain understanding that he could go ahead and have a conversation with God on almost like equal footing. That's not the way it works at all. Chapter 40, notice in verse 10. "Deck yourself now with majesty and excellency. Array yourself with glory and beauty. Cast abroad the rage of your wrath. Behold everyone that's proud and abase him. Look on everyone that's proud and bring him low. Tread down the wicked in their place. Hide them in the dust together. Bind their faces in secret." No human being can do that. Oh, we can kill people. We can kill people. But can we get the right person? Can we? We're flesh. We're not able to go ahead and do these things that God can do. And if we go into chapter 42, finally it dawns on Job just who he's dealing with. "Then Job answered the Eternal and said, I know that you can do everything. No thought can be withheld from you. Who is he that hides counsel without knowledge, you've asked? Therefore I've uttered those things I didn't understand, things too wonderful for me, which I knew not." In other words, he suddenly started to see. As he says, "Here I beseech you and I'll speak. I'll demand of you and declare to me, I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear. But now my eye sees you. Now I'm actually looking at this being, or looking at the effect that this being has. It finally has sunk home what you're talking about. Therefore I abhor myself and repent, mere dust and ashes." That's all it means. It means that he's repenting, he's turning from what he was, because all he is dust and ashes. There's nothing there of any consequence. All the righteousness, this rich young ruler, "All these things I've done since my youth." No, he hadn't. That's not enough. That's not good enough. Yes, he's kept them in a physical way. He's kept them as a human being. But we've got to be converted to become God. Look at the being we're dealing with. Look at the being we're dealing with. That is a completely different kettle of fish. Let's go and consider the lily. And in introduction, let's have a look at Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. Because it begins in Hebrews chapter 11, talking about faith is the substance of the things hoped for, the evidence of things that you can't see. It's what you've got before you have the reality. And what you have is not just an airy-fairy idea, an airy-fairy feeling. What you have is a grounded belief that then leads to an action. It leads to a life that is changed. It leads to evidence that you can see, in the sense that the faith does something within the life. The faith produces something. For it says, "By it the elders obtained a good report." And a better translation of chapter 3, which fits better because it actually it fits in the time sequence, is that we understand that it was through faith that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that things that are seen are not made of things which do appear. So what we see out there is the evidence of God's faith. God says, "Let it be," and it is. And we come along and we see it, and it's the evidence of him having created it, of him having made it, and what he did when he actually made it, when he conceived it in his mind. When we look at these flowers that are in front of me here, the lilies of the field, we're looking at something which is there because of the mind of God, because of the thinking, the thought processes of the Creator who we address as our Father. And we're looking at them, and we're examining them, and we're contemplating this being. It's the evidence of the things that it says, of the substance of things hoped for. It's the evidence of the things not seen. We didn't see the creation. We don't yet see the creation of man into the very family of God. But it's the substance of things that we are hoping for. It's the evidence of the things that we're not seen. So we can see that. We can say, look, consider the lily of the field, a command by God. And it will teach us about this being. It will teach us about this individual. If you turn over to James chapter 2. James chapter 2. over a couple of pages. It says in verse 14, it says, what does it profit, my brethren, though a man say he has faith and hath not works, can faith save him? You know, is it just going to be faith that is there? Do you just sit and believe? Is that all faith is? Faith is more than that. Faith produces an evidence. It allows you to see the result of that belief. If a brother or sister be naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you say to them, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, notwithstanding you don't give them what is needful, what does it profit? In other words, if we know somebody needs something, we know also that it is good for them to have that, and we don't help them, we say, be warmed and filled. Does a word, be warmed and filled, actually help? Does that actually do anything? He says, even so for faith, even in the same way, faith, if it hasn't works, is dead being alone. You've got to have works with it. You've got to have evidence in what it actually drives you to do. Yes, a man may say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. Now remember, who is actually saying this? Yes, it's James, but it's James under inspiration of the Spirit of God. This is actually God speaking to us and saying, look, you say you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without your works. Yes, but I'll show you my faith by my works. And the faith of God, the faith that we can see, and we can actually look at his faith, and we actually see, if you like, his faith in our future. The fact that we can, it's the substance of things hoped for. It's the evidence of things not seen. It's it's the substance of what was hoped for. It's the evidence of things that we can't see, the creation. We can't see it. We can't see what's to take place in the future, but we can see what is actually there in front of us. Now, if we turn back to Matthew 6, where this command actually appears, Matthew chapter 6. And it's interesting, it comes not that far from what we were reading, the sample prayer earlier on in Matthew 6. And it comes on into let's pick it up in verse 24. No man can serve two masters. For either is he going to hate one and love the other, or else he's going to hold to one and despise the other. You can't serve God and material wealth. You can't serve the two. Therefore I say unto you, don't become over anxious. Don't become unglued. That's literally, don't come to pieces. That's what it literally means. For your life, what you're going to eat, what you're going to drink, or else for your body, what you're going to put on, isn't the life more than the meat and the body than raiment? Behold, and look at this is again, it's a command. Look at the fowls of the air. Look at the birds of the air. Take the time to get out there and look and think. Look at the fowls of the air. They don't sow, they don't reap, or gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much better than they? God can go ahead and do that for us. Which of you, by taking thought, can add a cubit to his stature? Can you add a couple of feet, grow a couple of feet if you wanted to? But you did. You did at puberty. You did as a youngster. Can you do it again? Well, no, we can't. You can't take thought and do that. We don't have any control over it. And why do you take thought for raiment, the covering, for even for housing? Say, I remember one time when we had some housing for 6 months when we first moved down to the southeast, and we're in this temporary accommodation. And that was going to go on. We knew it was going to go on for 6 months. We had a couple of months left, and we were looking for another place. We're going around. Judy was 6 months pregnant, 7 months pregnant, something like that, with Robin. And we didn't know it was Robin at the time, but she was 7 months pregnant anyway. And we needed a home. We needed somewhere to live. I had come back from Wales, and I'd come back to the southeast because they needed somebody to look after the media side of things over there. And I was working for the Work at that time. And I know that Judy, has put it down in her list that she remembers a particular time that she was walking around a store, a supermarket, almost in tears, that quite frankly, you know, can't you see I'm pregnant? Can't you see that I need a home? That we, you know, what are you playing at, God? Almost, you know, I'm sure she doesn't mind me actually mentioning it. And yet within 3 days, we had a place. Within 3 days, we had the keys. And I sent out about 25 letters I sent out to farmers in the area, because we didn't want to live in a flat somewhere. We'd been living out in the countryside down here. We wanted to find a place down there. And we went ahead and we sent out these letters. And half of them came back saying, sorry, we don't know of anywhere. We're asking the question, do you know of any cottage that is available for rent on a farm? Half of them came back and said, no, we don't know of anywhere. One came back saying, yes, come and see me. And literally within 3 days, I had the key. And so, you know, why do you take the thought of the raiment for covering, for housing that you need, for what these things that you want? And let's face it, as we go into the future, in this present economic climate, as we see what is happening economically in the world, these things are real. This is not an academic exercise. This is not kind of some nicey-nice religious feeling that we've got. This may be real. It may be you, it may be me. We may find ourselves without a home. But he says, why do you take thought for raiment, for covering? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. Do you know something? That we didn't know how a lily of the field grew until the last few years. When Mr. Armstrong was alive, we didn't really understand it. It's only in the last few years that we really have begun to understand this. And now, yes, we understood this so much that they don't toil, they don't spin. And yet I say to you that even Solomon in all his glory isn't arrayed like one of these. One of these lilies that we see, I'm looking at them right now as I'm talking. There isn't, Solomon himself isn't arrayed like that. Now if I can just give you a little, because it goes on, it says, therefore, if God so clothe the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is cast into the oven. I mean, these are going to be dead within another week. Those particular flowers, those blooms will have gone. Shall he much more clothe you of little faith? You see, the faith, we should be able to look at the, it says, examine the lily, see how it grows, and then understand something about faith. Now, what I'd like to do, I'm not going to go into any kind of scientific mumbo-jumbo, which I know people don't like. So what I want to do is I want to make an analogy, and I wanted to explain to you what it's like as far as a lily growing is concerned, and put it in everyday terms, and see if that, finally, trying to get this across, that this is the mind of God. It's not science. Science merely has studied this. Science merely has discovered it in the last few years. But what we are actually looking at is the mind of God. It is the way in which God has made the lily to grow. And it says, consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. So how do they grow? Imagine somebody came to you. So I'll look after your housing for you. Don't worry about it. And he said, look, what I want you to do is go and see this island over here and see the housing that I've made there. And then understand that what I'm telling you is true. That's really what God is saying to us. He's saying, look, go and have a look at the lily and understand. So you get in the plane, you fly off, you go to 35,000 feet. And as you're coming down towards this island from 35,000 feet, you see this incredible, beautiful lily that is actually a pattern on the island. And beside it is another one that is being developed. And this is obviously some kind of housing development. And so you land, the plane lands, and you get out, and you start to wander around on this housing development. And here is a development that literally looks with stunning beauty as a lily. And you go and you find that, no, it's not just a housing development. There are villages, tiny little villages, just a few houses each, but you know, enough that there are several thousand, you know, multiple thousands of these little villages all over, and it's the roofs of these villages that you're actually seeing as the green
part of the lily, or the white part of the lily, or the stamens of the lily, or the roots of the lily, which actually go into the sea. And these villages are such that they're all very similar. They're all slightly different, because, I mean, some of them have white roofs because of white lilies, and some of them have green roofs because they've got green solar panels on. But they're all similar. They're all designed in a very, very similar way. And at the centre of this village that you notice is a library. And in this library is a series of volumes, several hundred volumes thick. It's like almost like an Encyclopedia Britannica. And the whole place is automated. I mean, it's automated in such a way that there are robots going everywhere in this village. You don't see any human. There's no human there at all. There's nobody directing them at all. The whole thing is working automatically. And you go into this library, and you see this reference library. You see these hundreds of volumes that are in this reference library. And these robots are going in there to get little shopping lists. And they go in there, and they make the request known to the individual that's or the individual robot that has control of this library, and he'll pull out a volume and he'll photostat a particular page, put it back into the thing again, take the page and give it to the other robot. The robot then will trolley off to the store. In the store, you have these great arrangement of boxes. There are 20 different types of boxes in the store, and these 20 different kind of boxes contain components, and that's all there is, just 20. And he looks down this shopping list, this robot, all automated, and he takes the first word and he pulls out the appropriate box, sticks it, unpacks it, and puts it onto his own. And you look at this thing, it's almost like a little tiny piece of Lego. And it's got magnets attached to it, and it's got Velcro bits attached to it. And it all clicks onto, you know, there's one is put onto a trolley. And then he looks at the next list, and he gets the next piece of Lego, of Velcro magnetic Lego piece, and it clicks onto the next piece. And one after another, he's clicking this, he's unpacking the boxes, putting the boxes back on the conveyor belt, they're going back into the place that actually manufactures this stuff. And one after another, he's clicking this Lego come magnets come Velcro stuff that's on this long trolley that he's got. And once he's finished and he's gone all the way down the list, he gets hold of this trolley, he pushes it into another machine, and the machine takes this long string of Lego come Velcro come whatever and starts to fold it. And as you watch, you notice that it actually folds into a door handle. The whole thing becomes a door handle. And unlike other door handles, all the surface is beautifully polished. The piece that actually goes onto the door, however, has got magnets sticking out. It's a certain shape. It's got certain bits of Velcro in certain places. And it's got Lego in other places. And he then puts it on a conveyor belt with all these other bits jangling around, and off it flows. Now you follow the conveyor belt, and you go along with the conveyor belt, and you come to the building site where they're making this, you're looking at this lily that's actually growing, if you like, from this building site. They're making these houses. And this piece, you watch it, and what happens is all these different bits, there's a door about to form. And the door, first of all, the hinges jump off the conveyor belt and snap into the right place because they're Lego and they're Velcro and they're magnets, drag the piece into the right place and it snaps into the right place. That exposes another part, because he's got two pieces now. The other part then exposes, again, magnets and Velcro and Lego, that drags another piece off the conveyor belt, and that snaps into place. And this is happening almost, it's automatic. It's clicking into place. One piece after another is clicking into place. And finally, you see your door handle, because it comes into the right matching, corresponding place of the right magnets, the right Velcro, the right Lego, and it jumps off and it clicks into place. And you look at this thing, and this is happening all automatically. Nothing's, there's no human, you know, there's no gaffer. There's not, no humans doing anything. It's all automated. And it's actually, it's not just automated making this one tiny cell, this when you're looking at the village, but there are village after village after village after village. The ones that have the green roofs are making energy, and the energy is being piped down to the roots where they're mining the water and the minerals out of the sea, and they are flowing down into the all these little villages that have these storerooms, and they're making these, what are actually amino acids, these boxes, these 20 boxes that they and the people are, you know, these robots are running backwards and forwards, coming into the library, photostatting a page, rushing back, getting all the various bits and pieces in together, and it comes out, and it's a towel, it's a tile, or it's a window, clear window frame, or it's actually a piece of glass. One thing after another is being manufactured by these robots. And it's this information we would never have understood except to today. And it's only now, in the last 10 years. In fact, the first sequencing of any genome was actually 95. It was a bacteria where they actually found out the... When I say sequencing a gene, that's scientific stuff. Okay, everybody, all these glazed looks. That's the library. The genome is the library. It's in every single cell. Every cell of that lily has got the same library inside it. Every cell. Each cell is so small you can't see it. You can't see it unless you get a microscope on it. But inside that cell is a library. And inside that library are all these hundreds of volumes. Hundreds and hundreds of volumes. And when they wants to make some pollen, it will pull out the pollen page, copy the pollen page. And it won't just be a pollen page. It'll be the part of the pollen, the little hooks of the pollen, the little bits and pieces that are necessary. And the whole thing is growing. It's coming out of that. And this is, it says here, consider the lily of the field, how they grow. And why do you do that? Because he's saying, ye of little faith. Because we don't do that. We don't consider these things. No, we can go and you can put in your notes Psalm 91, verse 1 to 10, about how we'll be sheltering under the Almighty. He will give us our covering. He will cover us. And then he says, 10,000 will die on your right hand, 10,000 on your left, but he won't come near you. The covering will be there. He says here, if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is cast in the oven, shall he not much more clothe you, cover you, protect you? You of little faith. But we're divorced. Why are we divorced from these things? Because Satan wants us to be divorced from these things. Because we don't go out and plant seeds. We don't see these things grow. We don't have it as a part and parcel of our everyday life anymore. And it's orchestrated that way. Not only does it destroy us physically, it destroys us mentally as well. And we need to reclaim that. And we can, because there's an awful lot that has been understood recently. And we can start to understand things in a way that even in the days of Christ, although Christ understood them, because these are the systems that Christ made. Christ understood them. But the people around him, he put it in much, much simpler terms. Turn over to Psalm chapter 8, or the 8th Psalm, when we're looking at the creative grandeur. But in the 8th Psalm, it says, O eternal our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth. Who has set your glory above the heavens? So he sets his glory above the heavens. We see this creative grandeur. We can go out. Again, you live in a town. You can't go out and look at the stars because you've got so much light pollution. You can't do that. Out here, you can. You go out there and you can see the Milky Way. You go out, the clearest sky I've ever seen was 200 miles into the Sahara, at a place called Sokna. My brother and his wife took me out there when I was about 18, I think I was at the time. But I remember sleeping on the roof in the Sahara, and they, at about 11 o'clock at night, they turned the generator off, and the stars just about came down and met you. It was that, because there was no light anywhere for 200 miles. And the nearest town, the nearest light, would be 200 miles away. And he says, O Eternal, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth, who has set the glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and sucklings you have ordained strength, because your enemies, that you might still the enemy and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers. This is what Job didn't do. Job was thinking about himself. Job had his mind on how righteous and wonderful he was, and how wonderfully righteous he must become, instead of getting his mind focused on God and what his righteousness is like, and how radically different it is between Job and God. And yes, he must become like God to become a son of God, but that is more miracle than it is Job's enormous effort. The enormous effort must be to relax in the hand of God, allow God to go ahead and convert us, to change us, to make sure that we are submissive to what his will is, to make sure that we are quite obedient, and we're trying to develop that mindset, and are trying to relax and allow him to develop that mindset in us. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what on earth is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? For you've made him a little lower than the angels. You've crowned him with glory and honour. You've made him have dominion over the works of your hands. You've put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, yes, and the beasts of the field, the flowers and the fowls of the air, the fish of the sea, whatever pass through the paths of the sea. O Eternal, our God, how excellent is your name through all the earth. You know, once you start getting the focus right, when you start realizing who it is that made all these things and knowing a little bit about them, and let's take another one, Jeremiah 31. Jeremiah 31, verse 31, we think of all the time as, well, it's a new covenant, which it is. Behold, the days come, says the Eternal, and I'll make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was a husband to them, says the Eternal. But this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Eternal. I'll put my law in their inward parts. I'll write it in their hearts. I'll be their God, and they will be my people. And they'll not teach any more every man his neighbour and every man his brother, saying, Know the Eternal, for they will all know me. They'll understand his law, they'll understand his way, his mind, and they'll know God. They'll know me from the least of them to the greatest of them, says the Eternal, for I'll forgive their iniquity, and I'll remember their sin no more, giving access, therefore, to the Father. But don't stop there. Keep reading. Thus says the Eternal, which gives the sun for light by day, and the ordinance of the moon and the stars for light by night, which divides the sea when the waves roar, the Eternal of hosts is his name. This Eternal that they got to know, isn't this God that is stuck in the back pocket somewhere? It is the God. It is the one who created the lily of the field that we consider, the stars that we go out and see at night. For if those ordinances depart from before me, says the Eternal, then the seed of Israel shall cease from being a nation before me forever. And thus says the Eternal, if heaven above can be measured, and the foundation of the earth searched out beneath. Did I say, we don't know what's underneath the earth. We do not understand. We can't put a probe into the centre of the earth. It doesn't, if it ever went down there, it would never come back. Then if that was the case, then I'll also cast off the seed of Israel for all that they have done, says the Eternal. But the Eternal does understand. He does know. He is completely in charge.
And when we look at the creative quality, and we start to understand what I want to do, if I go over a little bit, I'm sorry, but I think it is worth doing so. Because I remember having a word with Mr. Ian Henderson, that's Philip's father, and he was talking about one time that he was down in the Japanese gardens, and he used to go around the college. He was the photographer for the envoy. So what he used to do is to keep a battery of photographs of the college in different times of the year. So if somebody wanted, say, something of the Japanese gardens in summertime, he said, which month do you want? Oh, I'll have one in May. Right, here's the one for May. And what he had little yellow markers that he put into the soil, and so he knew where to actually stand. And he would go and stand and he'd take photographs. When he was taking photographs one time, it was between two seasons. It was kind of, the spring had kind of gone, and I think it was maybe coming into summer, but there wasn't a great deal there, or maybe it was winter going into spring. But he didn't realise, Mr. Armstrong walked up behind him with another one of the lecturers. And the other lecturer says, what on earth are you doing taking photographs here now? I mean, at this time of year, I mean, there's nothing there to see. Mr. Armstrong said, hang on a minute. He said, hang on a minute. You open your eyes and look. He says, there must be 2,000 different shades of green alone if you look. But the trouble is, people don't look. People don't notice. You see, what happened, Mr. Armstrong was condemned. He was lambasted by people for being extravagant. But it wasn't extravagance. What it was trying to reflect the mind of God continually. He's trying to express that mind in a college setting. I mean, you go into Memorial Hall in Bricket Wood. Again, something Mr. Henderson reminded me of, is that as he went into Memorial Hall, on the floor was a rug. But it wasn't any old rug. It was a Persian carpet. Now the thing, it was a very large Persian carpet. It probably, to buy it today, you wouldn't get any change out of £10,000. Probably, I'm guessing. I've never bought a Persian carpet, but it would be in the thousands. Maybe it wouldn't be as much as that. I'm not sure, but it would be in the thousands. And yet, the classrooms were up the stairs, and on the side of the Persian carpet, there would be, what, 100, 200 feet, double them, twice an hour, walking backwards and forwards for 10 years. And yet that carpet was the same as it was when it was new. The quality was that great. It was able to last. And you could have gone ahead and got several thousand pounds. They probably did get several thousand pounds for it when they sold it again. Because even though it had that many feet that walked over that carpet, it was still of a quality that shrugged it off, because the actual knotting and everything else that is done is meticulously done in a Persian carpet. Now, where does that mind come from? Where does that understanding come from? Well, I'd like to read you a little bit of something I came across regarding something very, very, very small. And this is to do with a bacteria. Now, I'm sorry, it's a little bit scientific. Okay, I apologize. But I'd like to just explain to you a little bit about this bacteria. And it's actually a hair that comes out of the backside of a bacteria, a hair called a flagellum. It says, in just the past 10 years or so, and this is a very recent book, the work of many scientists in many labs in many countries detail how a flagellum is built in a bacterial cell. All these pieces have now been put together. So here is knowledge that literally is in, since the year 2000. They've just started to understand how this bacteria. Now, how many bacteria? As I said, you can get something like 1,000 million of them in the soil that you'd have in a teaspoon. Now, so how much is 1,000 million? Well, if you started counting 1,000 million, it would take you 31 years, if you're counting one a second, for 24 hours a day.
it would take you 31 years to count 31 million. And that's in one teaspoon. So, and we're looking at a hair, a whip-like hair that is growing out of the backside of a bacteria. And it's the same individual that actually made the lily and is using the same principles, you know, where he went down to the, and made the, on his trolley, and he got all the bits and he jammed them all together and they all locked together and he fed them into a machine that then folded them. Well, this is happening, but the folded bit isn't a door handle. It's going over to make this hair that goes on the backside of a bacteria. And the hair spins as much as 10,000 revs a minute.
It says the flagellum is built from the bottom up. The first component to be laid down is the basement, the protein ring in the inner cell membrane. Then, using that structure as the foundation, a sort of housing unit is built on the inside of the cell, called the C-ring. Inside the housing is then assembled a machine, which is an export apparatus. The export machinery is like a gun that grabs the correct proteins, which are suitably labelled so the automatic machinery can distinguish them from the proteins that are no part of the flagellum. It's on a conveyor belt, so it grabs the right one. And it says, and it pushes them to the end of the growing structure. The first proteins to be pushed through are those that make up the rod, along with a special protein that can chew through the cell wall. So it's getting them off the conveyor belt, and it's pushing them one by one. It's inside the bacteria, and it then pokes its head right through the cell wall. Now, if you leave that as it is, it'll start spewing out. It says here, the first proteins to be pushed through and makes up the rod. That is needed so the flagellum can grow beyond the stiff boundary of the cell. The next stage is the assembly of the other rings. The proteins that make up these structures don't come through the regular way, however. They are pushed out of the cell by a different set of machinery that is used for the secretion of a variety of other proteins. The proteins that make up the P-ring cannot get into the incipient flagellum by itself. It needs another protein called a chaperone to shepherd it over the construction site. Otherwise, the protein loses its way and never arrives. So this is happening in the backside of a bacteria, of which you can get 1,000 million into the soil, of living in a soil, on a teaspoon. And you want to know what kind of mind we're dealing with? After escorting the P-ring protein to its proper destination, the chaperone floats away. Once the rod is finished, another protein is pushed through the middle of the growing structure to start the hook. The protein isn't the one that will be part of the final structure, however. Rather, it's called the hook cap protein. It helps to keep the actual building components in place as the flagellum grows. After the hook is assembled, the hook cap falls off and floats away. The protein that makes up the junction zone is then grabbed by the export machinery and sent through the export channel to the end of the nascent flagellum. And finally, we're just about ready to start the business end of the flagellum. All of that was making the motor that makes it twist, and just the projection just outside the cell wall. The propeller that actually pushes the bacteria forward. But before we do that, there's another critical step. Just as the construction of the hook region needed a cap at the end, so does the propeller. But it's not a hook cap, it's a different cap. So before the protein pieces that make up the propeller are sent through the export machinery, a filament cap precedes them. Now these are being sent up the inside of this little hair. The inside. The cap fits on the end of the hollow flagellum, and as each of the tens of thousands of copies of the propeller protein are pushed down the centre to the end, the cap prevents them from spewing out into the surrounding liquid and being lost. In order to traverse the rather thin, hollow centre channel of the flagellum, the flagellum proteins have to be kept in an extended shape. Remember, you get your trolley and you move your protein into this machine that then folds them and all clicks them all with the magnets and everything else. But it doesn't quite finish the job. It leaves them squashed and flat. Then it sends them down to this bacteria backside and is thin enough to go up the centre. And as it says, when they arrive at the far end, the cap also helps. It goes on. It says the filament cap is made up of 5 copies of a single protein whose official name is FLID, but I'm going to call it Twinkle Toes.
When stuck together, the five protein parts give Twinkletoes a shape that might best be described as a starfish on stilts. Now remember, this is happening at the backside of a bacteria. The leg-like stilts point vertically down from the horizontal pentagonal starfish. Now, the hollow filament of the flagellum is made of multiple copies of flagellum protein arranged in 11 strands. So this is the hollow column that's being made. So the five-fold symmetrical cap is slightly mismatched to the end of the filament. One leg of the cap can fit in a crease between every other strand, but 2 times 5 is 10, it's not 11. So one crease doesn't have a cap leg stuck in it. So he's made a cap which is slightly off. But the mismatch is not a mistake. It's part of the elegant design of the assembly system. As a copy of flagellum protein is pushed down the hollow tube to be added to the growing end of the filament, it is prevented from floating out into space by the filament cap. The cap allows the flagellum time to fold to its functional shape. So it goes thin as it goes down the centre, comes to the cap. The cap then has it fold to its final shape, reform, and to fill the empty space in the growing filament. So the mismatch actually directs the protein to the correct available position. As the flagellum fills the proper vacant position, the pentagonal cap rotates, so the next available slot is now in position to be filled. And to do this, Twinkletoes lifts one of its legs, moves it over a notch, and the next copy of flagellum then comes down the following tube to the filament, directed to the right spot. Twinkletoes rotates again to the next space, and the next leg swings over. Tens of thousands of times, the dancing machinery automatically directs the right building blocks to the right positions, lifts its supple legs, and spins to the next position. And it's all happening on the backside of a bacteria. This is the kind of mind that we're dealing with. Now, you know, people say, oh, I don't like this horrible scientific stuff. It is not scientific stuff. This is the mind of God. This didn't come about by blind chance. It was made. It was designed. It was created by the Creator. And if we turn over, final scripture, turn over to 1 Peter. 1 Peter. And this is the point. We're going to need faith in the time that's ahead. Faith that we will in fact be ready when the time comes in 1 Peter chapter 4. And yet, as it says here in 1 Peter 4 verse 12, it says, Beloved, don't think it strange concerning the fiery trial that is to test you as though some strange thing happened to you. They were having difficulties at that time. But you don't, you know, you remember the lily. Consider the lily, how it grows. Remember the backside of a bacteria and the flagellum. In verse 17, For the time is come that judgment must begin at the house of God, and if it first begins, what is going to be the end of those that don't obey the gospel of God? And if the righteous scarcely be saved, where will the ungodly and the sinners appear? Therefore let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing as unto a faithful Creator. This is a faithful Creator, the same Creator that makes a lily, the same Creator that has the design and the detail and the creative quality to come down to a hair that comes out of the backside of a bacteria. Design. There's no way that can be anything else but designed. There are so many multiple parts in it, all of them working and coordinating together. And it's the way in which it's actually constructed that is so utterly, totally amazing. And we didn't know that. And we didn't know all this about the cell of the lily 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So consider the lily. You know, this faithful Creator, with the works all around us, that if we get out there and we look at them and we consider them and we understand a little bit about them and stop being so blinkered and so urban in our view, and start taking a view of which we are supposed to be teaching in the world tomorrow. It's not going to be an urban view. We're not going to have people living in condos. They're going to be out there growing their own food, so they plant the seed and they see the result of it. And so consider the lily, how it grows, O ye of little faith.